From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this is Glenn Beck talking about Occupy Wall Street.
Capitalists, if you think that you can play footsies with these people, you're wrong. They will come for you and drag you into the streets and kill you.
Last week, we likened the progressive populist protests now collectively known as the Occupation to its anti-government analog, the Tea Party. But the Tea Party, or parts of it, objects to that comparison, and according to Politico's Ken Vogel, has launched a media campaign to fight it. Ken, welcome back to On the Media.
Great to be with you, Brooke.
So what exactly are these Tea Party organizations doing to delegitimize the Occupation?
Well, we're seeing sort of a two-pronged attack. In one prong of it, the organizers of some of the biggest Tea Party groups are seeking to draw distinctions between what they see as the message, or rather lack of a cohesive message coming from the Occupy protest, and what the Tea Party says that it always had as its undergirding focus, being the growth of government and government spending. The other thing that the Tea Party activists and their organizers are doing is seeking to actually collect evidence of bad behavior, offensive signs, violent rhetoric coming from some of the Occupy protests and disseminating them on conservative blogs and conservative social media with the hope that this evidence will eventually percolate through to the mainstream media and sort of turn public opinion against these protesters.
That sounds kind of familiar.
It sounds extremely familiar to exactly the type of perhaps less concerted campaign, but a campaign nonetheless by liberal activists and Tea Partiers, would say, the mainstream media to shape public perceptions of the Tea Party in its early days. You heard some of the exact same criticisms of disorganization and confusion of message. You heard some of the same criticism about violent rhetoric. You saw almost identical photos of signs that were deemed to be outside of the mainstream of the public debate that were taken at Tea Party protests, as you now see Tea Partiers circulating from the Occupy protest.
James O'Keefe, notorious for his Acorn and NPR stings, recorded himself talking to what he saw as the most ideologically incoherent members of Occupy Wall Street.
One of the criticisms that there was of the criticism of the Tea Party is that it's easy in any big crowd to find someone who is going to espouse rhetoric or messages that are deemed to be offensive or potentially disruptive to a civilized public dialogue. And Tea Partiers really reacted harshly when they thought that the media was doing this to them. Now, however, you see them openly embracing these same tactics to try to marginalize the Occupy protests, and they're fairly frank about it.
Another angle that the Tea Party has been working is co-optation by unions and the Democratic Party. Again, a strategy exactly like the left was using against the Tea Party, calling them astroturf and co-opted by the Republicans.
In the case of the Occupy movement, it's the labor unions. In the case of the Tea Party, it was some of these large Washington-based conservative groups, some of which were in fact corporate funded, and they saw, hey, there's this groundswell of people out there who have a message that is in some ways similar to ours. If we can tap into that, then we can show that there's more popular support behind the things that we have been pushing for years. Both got criticized.
Apparently, they feel that the Occupy protesters were legitimized by the media too quickly.
Definitely, behind their engagement with the Occupy protest, you see something of jealousy towards the way they feel that these Occupy protesters have not gotten that same type of harsh media scrutiny as they got. And I think that there's some validity to their gripe here.
Are these attempts to delegitimize the Occupy protesters working, do you think?
Well, when you talk to folks who are actually encouraging and organizing these efforts, they say, no, it's not working. And they think that it is yet more evidence of media bias, that they can point to specific photos or videos that they think prove that there is just as much extreme behavior as was alleged to have been in the Tea Party movement early on, and yet the media is not in a real concerted way covering it.
So the left couldn't get rid of the Tea Party, and it looks like the Tea Party isn't going to be able to get rid of the occupiers. The only thing that either side can do is wait for the other to implode.
That's one of the strategies that you hear from Tea Parties. In fact, some of them are urging their colleagues not to engage. And they're saying by engaging with attacking the Occupy movement, it only elevates them. Therefore, there is a debate within Tea Party circles about whether they should engage at all or whether they should let this thing kind of run its course.
Winter's coming.
Right. Maybe they'll all go home, but certainly there have been many predictions that this thing would fizzle out and dissipate, and it hasn't.
Ken, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Ken Vogel reports for Politico.com. In more image management news, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, otherwise known as the Mormon Church, has launched a national media campaign. And not a moment too soon. Last week at the Value Voters Summit in Washington, Pastor Robert Jeffries, while introducing candidate Rick Perry, took a swipe at candidate Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney's a good, moral person, but he's not a Christian. Mormonism is not Christianity. It has always been considered a cult by the mainstream of Christianity.
Also putting the Mormons in the spotlight, the Tony Award-winning Broadway show The Book of Mormon, a couple of Mormon-related TV shows, and of course, Mitt Romney and John Huntsman, two Mormon presidential candidates. This month, after a long time in development, the church rolled out its latest effort to essentially reintroduce the faith and its followers.
I am a vice president of research for a major entertainment company. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a husband and a father. My name is Tom Noe, and I'm a Mormon.
The I'm a Mormon ad campaign is now featured in a dozen cities around the country. Ron Wilson is the senior manager for internet and advertising at The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He says there is a huge knowledge gap when it comes to Mormons.
Even though The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is the fourth largest church, 50% of the population didn't really know who we were. And of the other 50%, a lot of them were misinformed about the church and the members of the church. So the goal of the campaign was specifically to help people who have never been exposed to friends or family or acquaintances that were members of our church, that were Mormons, to give them that opportunity.
Tell me how you developed this campaign. What did your market research uncover?
We just weren't relevant to a lot of people. They just didn't think of us. And when they did think of the term Mormon, top of mind was family-oriented.
That's a good thing.
That was a good thing. But then there were some bad things. Secretive. Some said we were a cult. Some said we were weird. Now, what was interesting, though, is if someone knew a Mormon, it was completely different. That's when we said, wait a minute, we've got to get our arms around this and figure out how do we allow people to have a better experience or at least understand who we are.
So this new campaign, it's pretty impressive. A dozen U.S. cities, seven states, ads on TV, buses, billboards.
Yeah. I mean, our website, Mormon.org, we redid it to help people have an opportunity to interact with a Mormon. It was important to us to, if you can't have your own Mormon friend, we'll give you a virtual Mormon friend.
So when you say virtual Mormon friend, you're not talking about a computer-generated Mormon. You're just talking about connecting people online.
Exactly.
The campaign that I've been watching on YouTube doesn't seem to be about the religion at all. The theme seems to be, I'm just normal, nothing weird here, right?
Yeah, that's a lot of it. Some of it is specifically, hey, look, this is who we are. We're diverse. We're different. We live all over the world. And there's one common thing, and that is that we believed in Jesus Christ.
What is it that you think people are expecting, besides the not a Christian thing?
Well, that's the interesting thing about it, is that 50% of the people don't have a clue who we are.
Let's not skate around polygamy. Isn't that an issue?
Oh, certainly, certainly. That is one of the misinformation pieces that are out there. And so without us having to come out and say anything about it, it's not too hard when you start watching all of these people on Mormon.org who are Mormons, and you see that not one of them has a second spouse, that that's not true.
But what's the power of your website against HBO's Big Love and the reality show Sister Wives?
Yeah, I think most people realize that those are just programming for entertainment, that they've taken a small segment, and in some cases the HBO show, something that's not based on very much reality, and used it to try to get viewers.
The church commercials in the 1990s were branding the church as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Now the brand is Mormon. I was wondering why the word change.
Well, there was a disconnect. We did a really nice job of helping people understand that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is a family church. but it didn't do anything to connect Mormons to the church name. So Mormons are members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And we realize at this point, look, the nickname was given to us back in the late 1800s. We need to take that and own it and help try to change the feelings about it, because most of the people who called us Mormons then didn't really like us.
The church says that the new ads are entirely unrelated to Romney's or Huntsman's presidential races, and that, in fact, the ad campaign was in the works before either of them announced their candidacies. Polls suggest that there is a great deal of resistance among some to electing a Mormon president. Do you hope these ads will help?
It has nothing to do with that. I mean, it has nothing to do with Harry Reid, who also is a Mormon who's in politics, who's on a different side of the spectrum politically. The church has no position politically. We don't endorse parties. We don't endorse candidates. The only thing the church does is it encourages its members to be involved, to vote their conscience.
And in terms of the cultural spotlight, the TV shows, the Broadway show, and all of the coverage that focuses on Huntsman and Romney, do you think this is a net plus, a net minus, a mixed blessing? What?
I think it's just interesting timing. We're kind of calling it the Mormon moment. And for whatever reason, everything has collided at the same time. When we originally came up with this campaign and came up with what we're trying to do, it's never varied. And it was just to help people understand who we were, and so that they can come to our website, learn more about Mormons, and make their own decisions.
On the website, what's the most frequently asked question?
It wasn't what we expected, but it's, do Mormons believe in the Bible? And the answer to that is absolutely.
Which one?
We use the King James Version.
Okay, thank you very much.
You bet.
Ron Wilson is the Senior Manager for Internet and Advertising at The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Coming up, the life and times of the bleep. Coming to an end? This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. On October 3rd, the Supreme Court convened its latest term. And as usual, there are cases that concern matters of surveillance, free speech, copyright, you know, stuff we like to talk about on the show. Adam Liptak covers the court for the New York Times, and he says he's looking forward to the case called the FCC versus Fox Television, which could effectively stop the FCC from regulating content on broadcast TV.
It's such a great case. You know, the court has in recent years been very engaged with the First Amendment. Now they have a chance to look at a really big question they haven't fully engaged since 1978, when George Carlin went on the radio with a very funny but very filthy monologue.
The famous seven dirty words, and that was on a Pacifica station.
Exactly. And back then, the court said that broadcast is uniquely pervasive and can kind of ambush children, and therefore the government can regulate broadcast. This new case involving some swearing on awards shows and some bare buttocks on NYPD Blue raises the question of whether we still live in that world where broadcast TV, as opposed to cable TV, is uniquely pervasive because broadcast stations are regulated and everything else is not. The government makes the argument that there are still some small number of people who still get their TV over the air, and those people may seek out solely broadcast as opposed to cable television stations because they want a safe harbor from the depravity of everything else that goes on.
Let's shift gears to United States versus Jones. It's up to the Supreme Court to decide whether the government can track a suspect via GPS without a warrant.
The case asks the question of whether the government or the police can sneak up to your car, put their own device on it, and collect a ton of information about you, whether you go to the liquor store, whether you go to the church, whether you visit perhaps a girlfriend. The federal appeals court in Washington said that was just too much information, that crossed a Fourth Amendment line. And the government says that you don't need a warrant, that all this device does is sort of enhances that thing police have always done, which is stake out my car, follow my car around in their squad car. Nobody thinks that's a problem.
Okay, but this particular law that's being challenged has a guy named Antoine Jones as its poster child, not a very attractive character.
Antoine Jones was, before his conviction was overturned, sentenced to life in prison for dealing in cocaine. This data allowed the police to track Mr. Jones's movements, including to a place where he kept his cocaine. It's not typically the good guys whose cases reach the courts, but these principles are meant to be neutral principles that govern good guys and bad guys, too.
Where do you think the Supreme Court will rule?
The notion that some collection of information is okay, but there's a moment at which it becomes too much, is a very hard line for them to draw. So several of the signs point in the direction of the Supreme Court saying, well, maybe this is okay, but we might come back at this, and there may be some stuff that's no good. It's also possible that the court focuses on the very narrow question of whether the police should be allowed to put something on your property. And that kind of property rights argument could conceivably appeal to some of the more conservative justices on the one hand, while the more liberal justices concerned about privacy might join up in them. So it may be that you get a ruling that you can track all you like, but you can't be sticking stuff on my car.
Let's talk now about Golin v. Holder, which is an argument against a law that was passed in 1994 that shrank the public domain. Basically, it took foreign cultural properties that were in the public domain out in order to put the United States in compliance with an international convention. This really upset filmmakers, conductors, people who use raw material in the public domain to make their own work.
The case was argued the other day, and it was clear from the argument that the justices understood that materials that are in the public domain that people rely on to perform symphonies and make other kinds of derivative works, to withdraw those from the public domain is a fairly bold step. At the same time, it's important to say that all this international convention did was restore copyrights to works that were, for various reasons, unable to be copyrighted in the first place. It didn't extend the copyright they would have been entitled to had these foreign works been able to be copyrighted here.
Picasso's famous painting Guernica, the British films of Alfred Hitchcock, stories by H.G. Wells, the drawings of Escher. I mean, these are building blocks of whole enterprises of artwork.
The government argues that American artists are better off because of analogous opportunities to get their work copyrighted abroad where it couldn't be copyrighted. The theory of the Copyright Clause of the Constitution, which grants copyrights for limited times, is that you want to give people an incentive to create by giving them a limited monopoly, but that ultimately their works will belong to everyone. The court, though, has already disappointed people committed to the public domain once when, about 8 years ago, it blessed a 20-year copyright add-on that didn't seem to help incentivize creation because it was being given to people whose works had been created long ago.
Right.
So building on that case, there's some reason to think the court might accept this 1994 law as well.
Here's kind of a weird one. The Justice Department is asking the justices to decide whether a 2006 law making it a criminal offense to lie about being decorated for military service is constitutional.
The law is called the Stolen Valor Act. It's a beautiful sort of law school hypothetical about the First Amendment. We hand out decorations to military personnel who give their all. Well, what if someone walks around with a medal he's not supposed to have? Can you make that sort of lie a crime? One of these cases arises in the context of some local politician saying he was awarded some very prestigious medal and he runs for office on that basis. And, you know, the voters in some sense were misled and perhaps some people voted for him, you know, on the basis of this lie.
Right. But Adam, I know where you're going with this. Politicians lie all the time. Supposedly, they pay a price in the ballot box for that. You don't throw a person in jail for lying. I mean, once you start on that slippery slope, where would it end?
Brooke, I'm trying to present this case as neutrally and as straight as I can, but my sympathies obviously are with you. I mean, in general, the government should stay out of the business of regulating speech, particularly through criminal laws.
So Scalia is going to kill this one, right?
I think here he will be persuaded that you don't need the full weight of the criminal law to go after the liar. You can rely on shame and other kinds of ways that society has dealt with lies since the beginning of time. It's a federal law. Striking down a federal law is no small thing. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if the court agrees to hear this case, too.
Adam, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Always good to be here.
Adam Liptak covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. Now, the FCC doesn't allow cursing on TV before 10 p.m., but if the broadcasters win in their upcoming Supreme Court case, they could. Probably broadcasters wouldn't go blue right away. Skittish advertisers would likely become de facto regulators. But eventually, standards could slip. OTM producer Chris Neary hopes that one trusty network tool doesn't get lost in a newer, possibly freer age.
You hear it everywhere, from The Daily Show.
Let the record show that our audience will share anything at times.
To a new show this year called Up All Night, where two new parents lean over the crib of their newborn child.
She is so beautiful.
Beautiful. Chris, you know what? We should probably cool it on the cussing.
Right.
Maybe we did it again.
Look, I'm not sure how damaging dirty words are to children or how much they coarsen the culture. These things are hard to measure. What I am sure about is that bleeping obscenities, when done right, is funny. Now, quickly, a word about what's at stake in that Supreme Court case. It's not exactly about bleeping.
The real impact of this case is on smaller stations, is on cutting-edge programming, on songs that push the envelope, on experimental programming.
That's Andrew J. Schwartzman. He's the senior vice president of the Media Access Project, a nonprofit law firm focused on media policy issues. They plan to file a brief in support of the broadcasters in the Supreme Court case. Smaller stations don't always have the resources to monitor all of their programming or to pay FCC fines. But how might the case affect bleeping? How about a show that bleeps really well, like Parks and Recreation?
It's entirely possible that the additional creative freedom that would come with reversing the FCC's policy would permit the writers of shows like Parks and Recreation to move more comfortably into touchier areas.
But the bleep in Parks and Recreation isn't just about censoring. It's a full-fledged comic device on its own. For example, in this scene, a character named Joan Calamazzo, a small-town newscaster who's recently divorced and very drunk, is at dinner with Tom and Ben, who are trying to steer the conversation away from sex and towards Star Trek.
They're making a sequel. But if J.J. Abrams and company expect us to believe that it's Spock with the romantic tension with Uhura and not Kirk, well, let's just say the message boards are going nuts.
I want to take you both home and bend you over and just at the same time.
It wouldn't have been funny if she just said, I want to, and then we beeped it. And then it was over. It had to really hit home.
That's Michael Schur, the co-creator of Parks and Recreation.
We, I believe, strung together two takes. We just decided, oh, it'll be way funnier if it's just like a 9-second beep, which gives you the impression that every single word she's saying is horrifying.
With all the cursing you can hear on cable stations and on the internet, the shock value is almost gone. Bleeping out curses actually reinvigorates them, allowing your mind to fill in the gaps with the vile and the unmentionable.
If you're willing to risk offending people by cursing, it means that you really believe what you're saying at that moment. It's not funny when it's kind of casual and kind of like tossing off words and throwing around F-bombs. It's about conviction and it's about really, really believing in what you're saying.
I really, really believe in the comedic importance of bleeping curses. And though sometimes I think it's really that we at public radio can't selectively, when the moment calls for it, use a well-chosen expletive, it might be better that way, or at least funnier. I asked Schur if he wanted to curse on public radio.
I was actually just thinking that I would say what a huge fan of National Public Radio I am. I just want you to know that, you sons of
Now that's conviction. For On the Media, I'm Chris Neary.
October 1st marked the end of the American Library Association's annual Banned Book Week, Lately, it's gotten some resistance from conservative critics who claim that the ALA is bullying parents who care about the kind of material their children might encounter in a library. Through the ages, children's books have been used to entertain, educate, socialize, and indoctrinate. As in A Guide for Child and Youth, an alphabet book from 1667, the entry for A, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. In 1935, the Communist Presses International issued another alphabet book in which A is for armaments, warmonger's pride, B is for Bolshe, the thorn in their side. Philip Nell co-edited a new anthology called Tales for Little Rebels, a review of radical children's literature from the last century. I asked him if he had a favorite in the collection.
One that I really, really like is The Day They Parachuted Cats on Borneo. What happens is that in order to get rid of these malaria-spreading mosquitoes on Borneo, they kill them with DDT. Unfortunately, it also kills everyone who preys on the mosquito, from the rats to the cats who eat the rats. And when the cats died, right, the rat population boomed. And so they literally parachuted cats on Borneo to take care of the rat problem. And it's a true story. It's actually one of the first books like that, The Day They Parachuted Cats on Borneo, Dr. Seuss's The Lorax, both published in 1971, the year of the first Earth Day, really right at the avant-garde of environmentally conscious children's books.
They made a movie out of The Lorax.
Now listen, all of you. I am The Lorax. I speak for the trees. Ooh.
That was The Lorax. He spoke for the trees.
It's one of Seuss's most controversial books because it upset some people in the logging community. In fact, the North American Wood Floor Manufacturers Association, I think that's the name, produced their own anti-Lorax book called Truax, in which you have a kindly white logger named Truax and an angry brown environmentalist named Guardbark, and the two face off, and Truax explains how loggers actually take good care of the environment, and cutting down lots of trees prevents forest fires and so on.
As you've noted, when the books become explicit or attached to political positions like environmental protection, they can really freak out the cultural conservatives of their day. Mm-hmm. There was a play called The Revolt of the Beavers that came out in 1936, which the New York Times Review called Mother Goose Marx. And the Saturday Evening Post said it would encourage poor children to attack rich children? I mean, was it that intense?
No. It's about a bunch of beavers who are oppressed, and a couple of kids find their way into their country with the assistance of one of the leader beavers who has been exiled, lead a revolution.
I don't think you care about the other beavers at all. They're sitting over there eating scraps of their own clothes while you stuff your face with all the bark you want.
So does anyone know if the kids got the message that their role in society ought to be as outside agitators?
We don't. And in fact, when a professor of psychology at New York University interviewed hundreds of child audience members, they told him that what they learned was never to be selfish and that beavers have manners just like children. For a single book to suddenly turn a child into a communist, that would be quite a feat.
Consider the Harry Potter books.
Sure.
They create these worlds where there are certain principles at work. Do these fall in the category, do you think, of radical books?
I think of them as political books. The central villain is a bigot. Voldemort believes that only, quote-unquote, pure blood wizards and witches deserve full rights in society. The good guys, Harry Potter, Dumbledore, Hermione, Ron, etc., don't believe that. So, I mean, the central political message in Rowling's books is really an anti-discrimination message. Is it radical? I don't know. In some ways, the most radical moment in the books is when Hermione forms the Society for the Protection of Elfish Welfare, which, incidentally, is a failed enterprise, in part because she doesn't understand the group whom she's trying to help. Rowling is a political writer. She worked for Amnesty International when she was younger, and that definitely informs her view of things. But radical?
So every few years, we hear about some new book that may warp the mind of young readers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm never in favor of banning books, but Do you think we have something to be concerned about?
The impulse to regulate is not a bad impulse. The impulse to regulate led to reform movements, to ban child labor, to give children free education. That's a good thing, to protect children, right? The flip side is that a better way to deal with books that concern you is to read them with the children and talk to them about what they mean, because it's your job to help children deal with the troubling aspects of the world in which they live. And I think if you respond to that simply by saying, let's ban it, you're really abdicating your own responsibility.
Philip, thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Philip Nell co-edited a new anthology called Tales for Little Rebels, a review of children's literature from the last century. Coming up, the blurred line between reality TV and reality in the world of professional wrestling. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at GatesFoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at MacFound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. On Tuesday, Attorney General Eric Holder announced that the U.S. had successfully thwarted an Iranian attempt to assassinate Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the U.S.
Factions of the Iranian government were behind a plan to assassinate the Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the United States.
On U.S. soil, and it includes the planned use of bombs and a foiled murder-for-hire plot that, get this, involves an opium deal with a Mexican drug cartel.
Two men, one a naturalized U.S. citizen, another an Iranian, both charged.
Can't make it up, and it is indeed both terrifying and perplexing all at the same time.
The news was met with a swift reaction by the Obama administration, with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton calling the plot a dangerous escalation for which Iran must be held accountable, and Vice President Joe Biden on the morning talk show circuit. Here he is on Good Morning America.
And so this is really over the top. They have to be held accountable. And we're in the process of uniting world public opinion toward continuing to isolate and condemn their behavior.
The U.S. has already imposed new sanctions on Iran and is proposing more. But a number of experts on Iran have questioned the plausibility of the story. The American media were criticized in 2003 during the run-up to the war on Iraq for accepting Bush administration assertions at face value. But according to Atlantic associate editor Max Fisher, the media are doing a better job with this story.
Usually something like this, the media angle and the media coverage tends to emphasize the threat, the danger. Here's how the U.S. government is responding. Here's the larger threat behind it. But the media response this time has been a lot more nuanced, and they moved to that really quickly.
Almost immediately after Holder's announcement of the alleged plot, you wrote that the Obama administration's story was possible, but that a lot of its elements didn't really add up. How so?
Well, it's true that Iran is a state sponsor of terror, and it's true that Iran has a pretty bad relationship with Saudi Arabia. It's not clear what they would get out of this. It's really not clear what it would do for Iran standing in the region or in the world. The Quds Force is brutal, but they're not driven by ideology. They're very cool-headed in what they choose to do and don't do.
So what questions do you think the media should be asking right now about this alleged assassination attempt?
Why would the group do this? Is this consistent with what the Revolutionary Guard has done before? Is it consistent with Iranian interests? What ways could this have happened other than what the government presents? That doesn't mean assuming that the government is lying, but asking more questions about the incident itself instead of the usual response, which is asking, okay, well, now that this happened, what comes next? This story is absolutely full of holes, and some of the bigger outlets, The Times, Reuters, The Financial Times, Christian Science Monitor, have been taking an objective, careful stance and saying, listen, there's still reason to think it might be true, but really aggressively exploring questions about what actually happened and what the government is saying has happened. Although, you know, you can still see the kind of what you might call the 2003 Iraq run-up style of coverage on this. The Washington Post response was to run a story looking at why Iran would want to kill a Saudi ambassador. Very accurate, very professionally done. It was a great story. But it does reflect kind of an overall editorial assumption that when we hear about a threat, our response as part of the media is to explain it rather than being a little bit more of a watchdog on the claim of the threat.
Have you noticed a difference in the coverage in the broadcast media versus the print media?
I haven't really watched much cable news. Yeah.
Max, we seem to be at a bit of a loss. Most people get their information from television, which you don't consume. How about the blogosphere?
You know, the blogosphere has been interesting. Immediately, you very understandably saw across the blogs people explaining, okay, well, why would Iran have done this? But within just a couple of hours, there was a much quicker turnaround. And I think a big part of that is the fact that the blogosphere has a lot of policy experts, field experts, academics who might not have the same incentive structure as a journalist. Gary Sick, who is on the National Security Council under Ford and Carter, published a blog post. He made a similar case to what I and other people would have made, that if this is true, it would depart from everything that Iran has done before, and there's very big reasons to be skeptical of it. And, you know, he put this up in his blog, and a lot of people could access it, including a lot of reporters. And I think it really very quickly shifted the tenor of the coverage. And I think that's one of the great things about the blogosphere, is that there's less of a wall between policy experts and readers.
So, given the caveat that you are principally a newspaper guy, you think that the coverage was better this time, partially because of the slam against the media for its run-up to the Iraq war coverage, and partially because of the expertise that's coming out of the blogosphere?
I think that it's mostly the media habits that were developed after September 11th have been falling away. And I think that, you know, socially in the U.S., there's much more of a skepticism towards terrorism than there was even just 1 or 2 years ago. I mean, if you go back to 2009, the underwear bomber, Umar Abdulmutallab, who tried to blow up the plane over Detroit, I think it was like the day before Christmas, the media response was the same one that had been there since 2003, which is to immediately say, wow, what is the scary group behind this? Then the kind of day two and day three stories were about, what do we do about this group in Yemen? How much of a threat do they pose? Should we intervene militarily in Yemen, which we didn't do, but we did send a lot more drones. So it's been a very recent shift, I think, towards this model of skepticism.
After the announcement, the White House acted quickly on sanctions. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton immediately called the plot a dangerous escalation for which Iran must be held accountable. Vice President Biden did the morning show circuit on Wednesday, talking about uniting the world against Iran's behavior. What do you make of this swift, coordinated response by the administration amid what you think is appropriate skepticism?
The way that they have organized the departments all releasing their announcement at the same time and ending those announcements with here are the policy actions we're taking certainly suggest that there's a big policy end to this and that that is sanctioning and isolating Iran. Now, it's an open question whether they earnestly arrived at this after hearing about the plot, but it does certainly give the appearance that they are using this to pursue a policy end that they had in mind before hearing about the plot.
Doesn't it have an eerie resonance with...
Yes, it does.
...with what we know about people in the Bush administration's desire to go after Iraq prior to the events of 9/11?
Someone pointed out to me that the U.S. would be unlikely to bring this in a court case, which is what Eric Holder is doing if they didn't think they had a pretty good case against these guys. But this does have a fairly creepy resonance with the 2002-2003 case for war against Iraq, which may be part of why the media is trying to raise all the questions and skepticism that it can.
Okay, Max, Next time we call you, you have to watch some TV.
Absolutely not. I refuse.
Max Fisher is an associate editor at The Atlantic. This week, there was some drama, reality TV style, outside the ropes at World Wrestling Entertainment, or WWE.
As long as we stick together, nobody cracks, can't be ignored.
Frankly, this work environment that we're in, well, it sucks. And I'm not going back in there until I get some respect. I probably wasn't even going to be on Raw tonight.
That was footage from the pre-show Solidarity Rally before Monday's episode of WWE Raw, USA Network's professional wrestling SmackDown, enjoyed by 4 to 5 million people each week. The previous week, WWE staged a labor walkout by superstars, divas, referees, and announcers who gave a purported vote of no confidence to their on-screen chief operating officer, former WWE champion Triple H.
We vote no confidence.
I'm sorry, Triple H. No confidence.
I'm sorry. No confidence.
I don't know what anybody else is doing, but right now, I'm reluctantly walking out.
The talent was fed up with management and fighting for change. Well, according to the script. But given professional wrestling's unsavory rep as a real-life employer, the very existence of the walkout storyline is pretty surreal. David Shoemaker covers professional wrestling for Grantland.com and Deadspin.com. David, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So can you bring us up to speed on, first of all, the scripted storyline? Triple H apparently had this no-confidence vote coming for some time?
Right. Triple H was not very popular in his short reign as COO of the WWE, and many of the wrestlers decided to argue that they were the victim of an unsafe work environment and agitate for his removal on those grounds. This comes in sort of the broader context of a recent shift in WWE storytelling towards a more reality-based approach.
More backstage drama, as well as in the ring.
Right. It's not an entirely new thing, but it was a marked shift for the WWE to deliberately bring in varying degrees of reality throughout all of their shows and all of their storylines.
Well, that is the point here, right? Varying degrees of reality. Who is the actual COO?
I don't know that they actually have a COO, although that's a good question. It was, I think, just more of a designation to separate him from his predecessor as on-screen top dog, Vince McMahon, who's the chairman of the WWE.
And Vince McMahon is still chairman.
Correct.
And Triple H, whose real name is?
His birth name is Paul Levesque. When he came to the WWE, he was rechristened Hunter Hearst Helmsley, and he was playing a Greenwich, Connecticut snob.
Okay, so Triple H
right.
was relieved of his duties on the air, but in reality, he's still an executive at WWE.
He is married to Stephanie McMahon, Vince McMahon's daughter, and so has, in recent months, exerted a significant influence backstage as far as hiring certain wrestlers and making kind of broader storyline planning decisions.
So there's no actual real-life labor unrest currently underway in professional wrestling, right?
Not as far as I can tell. Although after last Monday, there was a lot of Twitter action from some of the wrestlers who had participated in the walkout, and they seemed to be complaining in pretty real-world terms about the lack of workers' rights in the WWE.
Okay, so this is weird. They were drafted to play act a walkout in which they really believed but has no basis in reality.
If I had to guess, I would say that the wrestlers were given the marching orders to go out and tweet as if this were real. But I don't think any of the tweets were scripted by anyone other than the wrestlers themselves. You have to assume that there's some element of real feelings in the words that these wrestlers have tweeted.
And as I mentioned earlier, that it's not like the WWE has a sterling record with regard to the rights of its employees. Here is Jesse the Body Ventura, former Minnesota governor, on Howard Stern's show last year.
The problem that I've had with the WWE for 30 years, Howard, is that they call their wrestlers self-employed. So they don't have to pay Social Security, and the wrestler has to pay 15% self-employment tax. Now, how are they self-employed when you're signed exclusively?
Right.
You can't work for nobody else.
It's a monopoly.
Yeah. They tell you when and where you'll work. They can totally control your life.
And you're an independent contractor.
And yet they call you an independent contractor. How has the government allowed them to get away with that for 35 to 40 years?
And didn't you have a problem in terms of unionizing?
Oh, yeah. I tried to unionize and almost lost my job.
An interesting side note to that story is that the rumor is that he was ratted out to Vince McMahon by Hulk Hogan, who is the top star of the day.
So if there are legitimate labor grievances, how did the writers come to cook up a walkout storyline?
I don't have any specific information about how the storyline came to be, but it's very clear that the way it was conveyed on the screen indicated a pretty plain anti-union bias on the part of the WWE. The main good guy stars did not participate in the walkout, and the clip played earlier on, as they made their no-confidence votes, the crowd was booing.
Right.
The crowd came down without any hesitation on the side of management.
So despite this depiction of these temporary strikers as disloyal renegades, is there still a possibility that life might imitate art?
It's a little bit hard to imagine because the status quo is so ingrained. John Cena, who is the top dog in WWE right now and for the past several years, has been on the record as saying that he doesn't think there's any reason for a union. And I think he said specifically that he didn't think there would ever be one because it's a question that's just not going to be asked.
Why not? I mean, these players get hurt.
They do. They get hurt frequently. And a lot of them work while injured all the time because they know if they take a week off to deal with a concussion or to deal with a sprained ankle, then that's a week that they're not working towards becoming more popular.
So why can't these guys join the Screen Actors Guild?
That's actually a case that Darren Aronofsky was making when he was doing publicity for The Wrestler, his movie that came out a couple of years ago. Actors are unionized in SAG and stuntmen as well. And no matter how you want to define a professional wrestler, it's somewhere in that continuum. All the fans that watch professional wrestling understand that it is fake. The lie that wrestling is based on is sort of like an unwritten agreement between the fans and the promoters. This tension between reality and unreality is what wrestling is based on. I mean, that's the entire thrill. And I think on some level that unionization, especially with the Screen Actors Guild, would be an acknowledgement too real that what's going on the screen is not completely real.
You love wrestling. That's why you
love
it
to death, yeah.
Would it ruin it for you if these guys signed up with the Screen Actors Guild?
No, it wouldn't ruin it for me at all. That being said, I don't think that's at the very crux of it. I mean, I think if there were a union opportunity and the WWE gave everyone full permission to join up, I think most everyone would do it. But they're not going to because the WWE is just too much of an institution. And really, they hold the careers of all the wrestlers in their hands. The question as to what wrestling really is the best part of wrestling, but it's also at the crux of this problem. I mean, people don't take wrestling seriously enough to really think about this issue. You don't worry that circus clowns aren't unionized, and that's, you know, the sadness of the situation.
Thanks very much.
No problem at all.
David Shoemaker, also known as The Masked Man, covers professional wrestling for Grantland.com and Deadspin.com. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, TJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, Brett Jaspers, and with more help from Gianna Palmer and Doug Anderson, and edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. Check out our website, where there's more OTM, including producer Alex Goldman's blog about how he's using the game Super Better to help recover from a hellacious injury. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Next week, Bob Garfield will be back with his reports from South Africa. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.